If I bleed tonight, if I am sad tonight, I don't have a job to find. And if I work tonight, if I'm so tired tonight, I'll fall asleep when I'm home, when I'm home. Hey everybody, and welcome to the Power Slam podcast. My name is Kenny McIntosh. If you don't know that by now, then hello, new listener. I am joined by, you know, sometimes milk goes off. Like the longer you have milk, it goes off and it turns out the cottage cheese. Well, gladly, like a fine wine, my co-host matures more year by year. He matures with age. He gets better with age. He is miles better today than he was yesterday. I don't even know how good he'll be tomorrow. It's Finn Martin. Hi Finn, how are you?
Oh, after that introduction, Kenny, I'm built up. I'm ready for this podcast. You know, I'm on top of the world after that introduction.
Well, don't go on BBC News. You'll come right back down to earth. It is early December, or it's the 10th of December, the day that we record this. I've got new internet, so I'm in the studio just now. There should be some. It should sound pretty decent, and we will hopefully not have any connection issues.
Sounding very clear, Kenny. You're sounding better already.
And you know, there's a lot coming up. We've got the election this week. We've got Christmas in a couple of weeks. There's a lot going on in the world. But before we kick off, I did want to actually bring up something. I saw it on my phone last night, and I thought, must bring this up. Yesterday was 6 years ago, or 6 years since the championship ascension ceremony that took place on Monday Night Raw, where they were doing the thing with Cena and Orton, where they were going to be, you know, unifying the titles the following Sunday at TLC. It was in Seattle, and they had all these former champions in the ring, like Shawn Michaels and Hunter and Punk and Bryan and Swagger and Del Rio. Brett was there.
Yeah.
And it led to that moment where basically the crowd hijacked Raw for Daniel Bryan, and kind of the Yes movement began. So I thought, just for shits and giggles, I'd ask you straight off the bat, what are your memories of that segment, and do you think, you know, 6 years later, how do you feel about it now?
My lasting memory of it was that Brett looked really miserable.
It's a change for Brett.
Now, I remember the segment, and it was something that Daniel Bryan referenced in, I think it was his retirement speech, didn't it? I'm sure he mentioned it in that.
Yeah, because it was the same crowd.
Yeah, it was a big, big moment for him. I know that. And as you say, it was like as if it became his segment and he was supposed to be talking about something else. There was all these people there. And I think they're kind of thinking, well, why have I been brought out? You know, what's my motivation here? What's my role in all of this? And it led to the Randy Orton versus John Cena match, right, at TLC. That was it, wasn't it, Kenny?
Where
he unified the titles very briefly. And I remember the issue of Power Slam that went on sale in January 2014 had this breathtaking cover photo of Randy Orton with both belts. I remember that being one of my favourite ever Power Slam covers from that era. So it gave us that shot there, or at least my photographer Mike gave us that shot of Randy Orton walking out on the stage with both belts. So I remember that. I'm not sure if I really remember that much about it. I mean, you look back at it historically, was this more significant than the December 2001 pay-per-view where Chris Jericho unified the titles? Which do you think was more significant, the Chris Jericho one or the Randy Orton one? Which do you remember most?
I mean, I remember them both being quite rubbish. So it's really, which one's more rubbish? I would say, I guess historically, the Jericho one is a bigger deal. Because nobody really remembers the Cena-Orton match.
We don't, no.
Whereas they did reference Jericho beating Rock and Austin in one night. I mean, he still references it. So I guess that one is more... But then both of those, I think within a year... Yeah, maybe within a year, both of those, the titles are split again.
That's right. It'd been undone. I mean, if we 2002, it was early September, wasn't it, when Triple H became the world champion.
Awarded the belt on Raw by Eric Bischoff.
That's right. And then Brock Lesnar became exclusive property of SmackDown. So yeah, that was, what was that? That was like 10 months on, wasn't it? So,
and then when Cena and Orton, they merged the belts in December 2013. How long did that last? That did last longer, I think. Did that not last through to maybe like, that lasted through to July 2016 when they did the brand split and they introduced the Universal title. So that one did last almost 2 years.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it did last longer, whereas, you know, the Jericho one lasted like 9-10 months before. Yeah, the belts were separated, or rather the Triple H got the brand new title, because the title he was presented with by Eric Bischoff on Raw, that was an entirely new title created from cloth. You know, that was, some people thought that was linked to the NWA title, which it wasn't. You know, it was the same physical title belt, but there was no connection between that and the belt that Harley Race and Dusty Rhodes and Ric Flair previously held. So yeah, it's, I mean, they always, I remember when the Cena and Randy Orton one took place, it just felt like something for them to do, because they run out of ideas and they needed a gimmick for that pay-per-view. And I never for a moment thought that this was something that was going to last for 5 years. I always thought it was going to be something that they would just do for this event, and then they'd forget about it, and, you know, normal service would resume in 2014, which is, you know, precisely what happened. So, yeah, these unification things, hopefully they won't bother doing one again, Kenny, because I think if they were to do it again, it would mean even less than it did in December 2013.
Yeah, I would agree. So we've got lots to talk about this week, as we always do on these shows. I should very quickly ask you about the AEW NXT rating, which is interesting from last week, because it was essentially the same. You know, AEW had 851,000, NXT had 845,000. The demos were very close. You know, we talked about it last week, and you'd said, you know, the number that AEW got the following week would be a sign. So what do you make of their number of going to 851? Is it a good sign? Is it a bad sign? Is it to be determined?
Definitely a good sign that they were you know, up a couple hundred thousand, wasn't it, from the previous week?
Yeah, I think they went up to 851 from 661.
Yeah, so I mean, that there was, well, we talked about it in depth last week. I mean, that was very worrying for them. So that there must have, lots of sighs of relief must have been heard in the circles of power in AEW when that number came in. So, I mean, it's still way down from the number they drew for their premiere back in early October. And, you know, they should really be, I mean, I'm sure they're striving to hit that 1 million mark. I think they'd be a lot happier if they could crack that and stay around about that figure. I mean, the fact that NXT's numbers gone up is, I mean, it's a real morale booster for them when you think about it, because it's just the NXT crew now, isn't it, Kenny? I mean, I must admit, I'm a week behind on my NXT, so I haven't watched last week's episode yet. So I'm not sure what happened on that show. But for NXT to get its numbers up to that level, I think is, you know, a huge sort of endorsement of, you know, the whole Survivor Series model of involving all three brands. It does seem like more viewers of Raw and SmackDown are now watching NXT. You would think that more of them are now making time for NXT each week. So I think NXT has been the big winner out of the whole, you know, Survivor Series three-way, three-brand, inter-brand feud. And the fact that they're drawing only this week, or rather last week, they only drew 6,000 fewer viewers than AEW. I mean, that's huge for them. I mean, NXT's got to be, I mean, okay, they're not in the lead at the moment, but they were, and it's very possible. I mean, it's feasible, isn't it, that they could take the lead again this week. It's very close there. So, yeah, it's an interesting one. It's an interesting one to follow.
Interesting time to be a fan. I was also going to ask you, just quickly as a news item, Cody Rhodes had done an interview where he talked about the idea that AEW, you know, they don't want to do house shows.
Yeah.
They want the allure of this to be the schedule, the idea that you work one day a week. some of the talent will do indie shows because that will keep their stuff up, but other people might not do it. It's the first time that I can remember this has been offered. Do you think this is a sustainable model for them long term, or do you think that, you know, with time they're going to have to start doing house shows to kind of make the money back on the contracts they're offering?
Can I just one last thing about AEW and NXT? Can I just say I think there's more pressure right now on AEW to maintain those viewing figures than there is on NXT, because NXT, when they first went head to head, AEW was far, far ahead of NXT, and it feels like, well, it doesn't feel like it. Obviously, NXT has closed that gap, partly because AEW's numbers have fallen. So I think there's definitely more pressure on AEW right now than there is on NXT. But to answer your question regarding house shows, that was the selling point of AEW, that they wanted to make sure that the schedule was manageable. Also, I don't know whether this was mentioned, but if it wasn't mentioned, I'm sure it was publicly, I'm sure it was mentioned privately. Can house shows be profitable for AEW? If they take it on the road, will they make money out of house shows? You would think that they would do the Wednesday night show and then maybe do a house show on the Thursday or the Friday, and then you've only got to buy one set of airline tickets for the talent, or two sets. You know, you fly them into wherever, and then they fly out of wherever the house, after the house show, wherever the house show takes place, they fly out from there and fly home from there. So you would thought that if you're going to do house shows, they wouldn't do, like, you wouldn't do them on a Saturday, because that would then incur even more costs, wouldn't it, with transportation and you know, hotels and everything. Well, So I'm not really sure whether they can make money out of house shows. That is the issue. And I'm not sure how often WWE makes money out of house shows these days. I mean, oftentimes house shows were a loss leader to sell merchandise, but these days people just buy the merchandise online. They don't have to buy it at the arenas, even though I know people do. But people have got so many more places that they can buy the merch from now that they don't have to attend the house show to make the purchase. I mean, so I don't know whether they're essential really to the AEW machine. And if they're going to run house shows and lose money on them, then what's the point of doing that? I'm not sure if they're going to or not. I think they did say when they were in the planning stages that they were thinking of doing major event shows, like say if they were to run Madison Square Garden or a big venue, they would potentially run a house show then. But I can't see them really doing a schedule of house shows, because that would be at variance with their whole mission of promoting running a company with a friendly schedule to the talent. So it's a tough one. I don't know the answer, basically, Kenny. I mean, I think if they can run house shows and make money out of them, and they can just run shows in major markets, and they'll say once a month or twice a month, then I think they should do it. And I think the talent would be happy of the extra dates and the extra work. But if they were proposing to do like two or three house shows a week, I think that would be a mistake. But I don't think they would do that. I think if they're going to do house shows, it's just going to be special occasions only in large markets where they can draw healthy crowds.
I think one of the things that I think AEW should be fairly happy with is that I've been kind of keeping an eye on how many people are attending the tapings, the Dynamite tapings. And I think the average number of people is 4,000 that they're getting. And I mean, that's a decent number to start with, given that you've not had a lot of TV. And they went back to, obviously, Chicago on the Thanksgiving episode. But I'm curious when they go back to markets for a second time, you know, have people went to a Dynamite taping and felt it was worth going back to another one? You know, that's always going to be the test. Because I know for me, like, I would not pay money to go to a WWE house show now. Like, I would go to a pay-per-view or a TV taping or something, but house shows don't really do much for me. I think they're maybe more of a kids thing now.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think the fact that if you ever go and see AEW, most of the time you'd either see a pay-per-view or you've seen a TV show, will be a good selling point for them to shift tickets, because if you're going to see it, something might happen. You know, a belt might change hands, you might see a big angle. So hopefully if that's what they're doing, then the live numbers should at least make it worthwhile that they are taking it on the road every week.
Yeah, I mean, I think if they're going to play a major market, and because they haven't run house shows yet, if they do decide to do that, the first few will be a huge novelty, just like the first few episodes of Dynamite Live were a novelty, and they sold out and drew big numbers because people wanted to be there at the first or the early television tapings. The same will apply to the house shows. So, I mean, if they're running some major market house shows, I think the first half dozen will do well, or the first one probably in each large market might do well if they run a Saturday. But, I mean, as far as running house shows on a regular basis, if you're running two or three a week, then the novelty is very quickly going to wear off. And as you said about WWE house shows, I mean, it isn't really a novelty going to see a WWE house show. You know you're going to see basically a routine match that's going to resemble something you've already seen on TV. And I think you're right. I think they do gear them towards a younger audience who is just thrilled to see the stars live and isn't really that bothered about match quality. That's really the target audience for house shows. I mean, you've got to wonder, haven't you, how much longer WWE will run them for. Maybe they'll scale back. And maybe that would be a good move for WWE to do that.
Do WWE make a lot of money now in house shows?
Well, I don't think they really do make a lot of money on them. No, I mean, there's been various times where they haven't made money, and obviously the times when they have done very well. But I mean, I know they've had a lot of attendance problems. For this is not a new thing, is it, for WWE house shows?
Yeah, no, it's been a couple of years. Because when you go and see a house show, it's like if you went and saw a house show in the Attitude Era or something, you know, you would have this stuff that would happen after the show, and it kind of felt like you were getting a lot of stuff, whereas now it's just... You know, it just doesn't feel as... But I mean, I will say this. I know that my friend Jamie took his wee boy Jude to the house show at the Hydro last month and said it was a really good show and it was a really good card. But I think especially if you live in America and they hit your town fairly often, like a $75 ticket is a lot of money to ask people, especially if you've got families and stuff, unless they really feel like they're getting a bang for their buck.
It is a lot of money. I mean, especially when, in a sense, they've totally devalued the product with the WWE Network by only charging $9.99 a month or $10 a month for your product and all that TV and all that content. And then you're asking someone to spend 7.5 times that money for one live event experience. I mean, there's quite a disparity there, isn't there, between what each costs and what you get for your money. Which was always going to happen when they deviated from the pay-per-view model, where people were expected to pay like $50 for a pay-per-view. Suddenly, if you're paying $50 for a pay-per-view, a $75 house show ticket doesn't seem exorbitant, does it?
No.
It seems very reasonable. But if you're only paying $10 for the pay-per-view and all that mountain of content each month, suddenly $75 seems like a hell of a lot of money.
So, it does. Times have changed.
Yeah, when you put it in those terms. So, but obviously the whole idea with the network was that we were going to have 2 million subscribers. And that never quite happened.
There's also some more news where we get to SmackDown Raw and the, I was going to say build to TLC. I think that's been a little bit generous. But they've announced the two headline acts going into the WWE Hall of Fame in April in Tampa. The first act going in is Batista. He's going into the Hall of Fame. If you're doing a Hall of Fame that's WWE based, he is going to deserve to go in there. He's not a Coco Beware. But like, what do you think? What's the legacy of Batista's career? Do you think that him coming back and doing the match last year helped it? Do you think that should he? You know, what do you think about his career? Did he leave at the right time? Was it right for him to come back? And how will he kind of be remembered? Or how do you remember him?
I mean, we all know he came back. He wanted to do that one last match. That was something that he talked about for years. Went back as a movie star. Had the match with Triple H, which we know lasted too long, but was not a phoned-in performance. I mean, I thought that was a pretty damn good performance by both men on the night, even though they did fall into the typical Triple H WrestleMania bear trap of being. It's not like they fall into it. It's like Triple H sets it up for himself and demands it. I demand that bear trap so we can both walk into it. And
Seth Rollins has been a victim of that bear trap as well.
Well, exactly. I mean, I think before WrestleMania this year, we talked probably at great length, probably to the point that people were sick of hearing it, about how we didn't want the match to last too long and what happened. Yeah, inevitably, it lasted too long. So, I mean, I thought Dave Batista's 2010 heel character was just tremendous. I've written about it before on my website. I mean, I wrote about it in Power Slam at the time. It was just hilarious. Just this dead-on send-up of himself with his huge ego. You know, it's Skinny Dave, Skinny Jeans Dave, wasn't it? That was what he was with the white-rimmed sunglasses indoors and a leather jacket with nothing underneath. I mean, he was just sending himself up and having a whale of the time doing so. And I thought it was tremendous back then. And then, you know, he returns for that segment with Triple H. And that was a really nice sell, wasn't it? Was that last year?
Was that the SmackDown 1000
segment? That's right, yeah. And they had that in-ring segment. It was really good. And they got the ball rolling, didn't they, on Batista versus Triple H there. And it got provoked a tremendous pop. People knew what was going on. People knew what they were driving. Because I'm sure the majority of the audience knew the story that Batista wanted to return to have this match with Triple H at WrestleMania and then retire. And then they followed through. They gave us it with Dave as the heel and Triple H as the babyface and Ric Flair involved. So, I mean, to me, he stepped off at just the right time, stepped back on and then disembarked again. Bowed out gracefully, announced his retirement on Twitter after the WrestleMania match, put Hunter over on the way out, which was absolutely fitting when you think that it was Triple H who did so much to put Dave Batista over back in their 2005 feud. So, I mean, it was just, he was returning the favour there. And I just thought the way it all played out, even though their match at WrestleMania was too long, I thought the way it all played out was just so well done and so pleasant to observe. And I think everyone got something out of it. The fans did, the company did, Dave Batista did, and this Hall of Fame induction. I mean, I don't know whether Dave's really that bothered about it. I mean, let's face it, he's doing all right for himself away from wrestling, isn't he? But I mean, I'm sure it'll be a pleasant occasion for him. I'm sure lots of nice things will be said about them. Most of them will be true. I think he absolutely deserves it. You know, I'm totally on board with this Hall of Fame induction for Dave Batista. Absolutely deserves it. What do you think, Kenny?
I thought he was rubbish. No, I'm kidding. I loved him. He's got a great story of his career because he became, you know, he came up through OVW and he goes to WWE and they give him that Deacon Batista thing and it doesn't quite work. And then he gets into Evolution and that made him. And he does the program with Triple H. But then there's a period between the end of his feud with Triple H and the beginning of his feud with The Undertaker, which was maybe about a year and a half time period, where he just didn't get it yet. Like, he was drafted to SmackDown to be the head guy in SmackDown, and he kind of took the huff about it. He didn't want to go to SmackDown. He saw SmackDown as the B show, even though the idea was that he would be the top guy there and hopefully could elevate it or whatever. But then when he had that Undertaker feud, that seemed to just really... It clicked. You know, and Taker hadn't had a good match in years at that point.
Yeah, it started Undertaker off on that tremendous WrestleMania run, didn't it?
Yeah, and then so he had this great run, and then he even seemed to kind of get that, like, he didn't seem to take the huff as much. You know, he famously had the WrestleMania match with the MAGA in 2008, and even though that match was kind of a throwaway and there was nothing really to it, he seemed like he was kind of okay with it. You know, his ego had kind of understood how wrestling worked, and then when he left in 2010, he kind of left in the greatest way possible by doing his I Quit promo in the wheelchair with the sling on and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. And then the greatest irony is the two returns that he made after that, WWE phenomenally misbooked him in how they put him across, and both times he managed to make both of them work. Because when they brought him back in 2014 as the big babyface, which they I don't know if a lot of people remember, the first thing he did, do you remember the first thing he did in 2014 when he came back on TV? So he's going to be in the Royal Rumble. He's the babyface. What is the first thing they had him do on TV on the Raw before?
I can't remember, Kenny.
He gets in the ring and hugs the Authority, Triple H and Stephanie. The first thing he does on TV. So that coupled with the fact that people were just so clamoring for Daniel Bryan off of what we talked about at the beginning the night before, the month before, with the Championship Ascension ceremony, when he won the Rumble, and he's just does not understand why people hate him because of it. He told the company, he was like, turn me heel. I'll go heel. I don't care. He did the job at WrestleMania. He did the job the following month. He did business the whole way.
Well, he didn't have much choice, did he? I mean, he returned the babyface. Then he wins the Rumble. It's utterly rejected by the audience. I mean, remember the match he had with Alberto Del Rio at, I think it was it Elimination Chamber?
Yeah, it would have been, yeah. The same pay-per-view we got, the Shield and the Wyatts.
That's right, yeah, that tremendous six-man match. But yeah, I mean, the fans utterly rejected that match. I mean, that Batista versus Del Rio match was not quite as bad, because nothing could be, but nearly as bad as Goldberg versus Lesnar at WrestleMania 20. And that was so utterly rejected by the audience, that match, that they were left with no choice. They had to turn him. So they turn him, and then he's involved in the WrestleMania 30 triple threat match, and him and Orton, then they did the job. It was Bryan who went over, one of the greatest stories WWE's told, at least certainly this decade. And then, you know, he does the Evolution thing versus the Shield, and Evolution put the young guys over. I mean, that was really nice to see as well. Really constructive. He got it. He was there to help others. He knew his time was essentially up and he was just passing through, and he was helping out the people who were going to be there permanently. I mean, he was, an inspiration, you know, just setting the example of how things should be done, how veterans should do business. And that was a really good little feud there. And then he quits. Batista quits. And then Seth Rollins does the heel turn. And that was all set up. And, you know, they all moved on. And Batista went off and did rather well for himself in Hollywood.
But the key thing was that he had learned from years before to not, like, he didn't take himself too seriously, it seemed.
That's right.
He went with a heel turn. He committed to it. He even said that he wanted to be the guy to tap at WrestleMania to Bryan. So he understood what it was. And then when he comes back at SmackDown 1000, I mean, because he also mentioned a couple of interviews that he had said to WWE when he left in 2014 that he'd like to come back and promote the Guardians of the Galaxy movie, and they passed.
Yeah.
They weren't interested. So he goes off and becomes one of the world's biggest movie stars. So funnily enough, they take his calls again. And they bring him back, and he's this big returning sort of dominant guy, but they make him a heel, but he commits to the heel character and makes it work. You know, when there was a, that might not have worked, but he was, I mean, because he's such a nice guy now. Like, people don't look at Batista and think he's an arsehole. You think, oh, Big Dave. You know, Big Dave's got the banter. You know, you wouldn't let John Cena into your house for a pint, Finn, but you might let Batista in.
Well, they think he's Drax, don't they? They've seen him as Drax in the Guardians of the Galaxy films and the Avengers movies, and that's who they identify Batista with now, as this guy who's got all the funniest lines, you know, and somebody who's just all this self-deprecating humour. So we all see him as that.
Well, because maybe he famously had that line on SmackDown 1000 where Flair was there and he said, "Keep it in your pants," and popped all of them. Like, Orton couldn't contain himself. It was great. But yeah, Big Dave. I couldn't be happier for him.
It really is. It's one of those sort of, you know, heartwarming story, really, of somebody who left and they did it. I think I don't know whether there was ever a proper bust up, like there obviously has been with people in the past, stars in the past, they've come back. But I mean, I think the lines of communication certainly were severed at various points where they just weren't interested, and then, you know, WWE, as you said, not surprisingly, when Dave's got all this box office muscle, they want to do business with him again. And he came back and he did it on their terms. But he wanted to do it on their terms, you know, because their terms were his terms. Because by 2019 or 2018, when they set the ball rolling on it, he knew what he needed to do and what was the right thing for business and the right thing for his character so that it would be remembered fondly. I'm sure the whole 2014 comeback with the, you know, the rage that was directed at him. I mean, I'm sure he was, that must have been, I remember at the time thinking, you know, he's come back after like, what would it have been, 3.5 years? I think he left in about May of 2010, I believe it was.
He did, yeah.
Yeah. So he's come back after 3.5 years, this major star, wants to be involved again, probably doesn't need it, but is doing it because he wants to do it and he wants to make WrestleMania more of a must-see event. And the fans utterly reject him because they wanted Daniel Bryan. So, I mean, it must have been one of those moments for him where he must have thought, was this the right decision to come back? Fortunately, they were able to adapt and they were able to basically change course with Dave and make it work. And he was absolutely committed to that and did make it work and left. And I thought his 2014 comeback, in retrospect, on balance, you kind of forget the start of it in January and February, and you really just dwell on, you know, March, April, May, June.
The spotlight with the golf vest on and all. I mean, he's so good. Just committed to it so well when like you say, after the Del Rio match,
yeah,
they just went with it. And the other thing is he's got a great kind of rags to riches story. I mean, I wouldn't say it's the best wrestling book, but I actually thought his autobiography was decent. Yeah. He did back in, what year would that have been? 08, 09 maybe?
Maybe a bit earlier. Yeah, something like that. Yeah, was it Batista Unleashed? I think I've got it somewhere.
Yes, yeah. And it's a really good book. And he kind of came from nothing. And, you know, he had his mum, who was like a single woman, who was also a lesbian. And he didn't grow up with a lot of money. So, like, there's something about him that just kind of warms me to him in a lot of ways. So he's definitely a feel-good induction.
Definitely. I mean, this is the guy that went down to the WCW power plant and was humiliated by the Sarge and didn't quit, you know, even though in a sense he quit the power plant because he worked out that he wasn't going to get anywhere there because they didn't want him. He was somebody that never gave up the dream of entering the wrestling business. And he did struggle. It did take him a long time to really get a feel for it and to really grasp it. But he really persevered. And I think at the end, he was a pretty good performer. You take him up to 2010, certainly that heel character. I mean, in ring, Dave was a lot of people better than Dave in the ring. But I thought he was pretty good in the ring. He was decent, at least, anyway. And if he was in there with the right opponent, he could have a good match. But he worked out that the character needed to compensate for his shortcomings elsewhere. And in his later career, he absolutely did. And he was a genuine main eventer. You know, he was a top guy, absolutely. And to me, I'm sure most people would agree with this, he's absolutely deserving of this Hall of Fame induction.
Should mention on Twitter, he actually, people had said, you know, there's somebody had made a joke to him. You said, you know, I know people are going to say that Orton and Hunter and Flair should induct you, but the only person that should induct you is Devon Dudley, you know, for their partnership. But he actually retweeted it and said that as much as all those people mean to him, he has asked personally that Fit Finlay induct him.
Oh, wow.
For personal reasons, I do not think that's going to get through, but it's a nice attempt to look back up. But the other induction into the Hall of Fame.
I don't think it'll get through either.
No, never. Never in a million years. The other induction is the New World Order, Hollywood, Hulk Hogan, Scott Hall and Kevin Nash, The Outsiders. The original NWO, which also means Sean Waltman gets a second Hall of Fame ring. Now, I have nothing against Sean Waltman. I think he's a very good wrestler. But, really?
Yeah.
Because to me, the NWO going in is the three. It's Hogan, Hall, and Nash. It's not DiBiase. It's not the Giant. It's not Six. It's the three.
What about Mike Jones, Vince?
Well, he apparently was asked, but unfortunately has commitments to Soul Train Jones over in AEW, so they couldn't make it happen. Got all that TV money. Can't get the Soul Train man in.
Quite your engagement at the gimmick table.
I do love the idea that WWE own all of his names apart from Soul Train Mike Jones. And that's what he's now called and probably going to be known as to modern wrestling fans. Anyway, the NWO as a faction going in with Sean Waltman as the weird fourth in this party. What do you make of the idea of them finally putting the NWO in? And should they? Should Hall, Nash and Hogan get a second Hall of Fame ring for their work in the NWO or not?
Well, I mean, Ric Flair's in. He's in twice, isn't he?
He is, yeah.
He's in twice. Bret Hart's in twice as well, isn't
he? He is.
Is anyone else in twice?
Booker T's in twice.
Booker T's in twice as well.
Which I know you endorsed fully.
Absolutely, yeah. So, I mean, regarding Sean Waltman, I mean, why is Eric Bischoff not the fourth man?
Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, this would have been the perfect time to put him in.
Absolutely. I mean, to me, Eric Bischoff should be in that Hall of Fame, and this would be the perfect occasion for him to go in there. I mean, that was the reason why Sean Waltman was called six, wasn't it? Because he was the sixth person to go in, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's correct, six pack.
The only other theory was that 1, 2, 3 added together adds up to six.
Well, there was that as well. That was the other one, yeah. For most conspiracy theorists. So, as far as the NWO going in, yeah, absolutely, the act deserves to go in. I mean, it was huge back in 1996 when it was formed at Bash of the Beach with Hogan coming out and cutting to me. Gotta be one of the best promos of all time. It's got to be top five ever. It always amused me that Steve Austin cut his King of the Ring acceptance speech. I think it was June 23rd or something like that, somewhere around about that, June 23rd, 1996. And then Hogan cut his killer New World Order heel turn speech. And I think that was July 7th, 1996. I'm not sure. Those dates could be 1 or 2 days out, but it was within about a 15 day period that these two incredible promos were cut by the two guys who were like, you know, well, we didn't know at that point that Austin was going to be the star that he would become 2 years later. But we knew, obviously, Hogan was a huge star. But I don't think any of us really knew or could have foreseen how big he would become as a heel. Because, you know, he did the heel turn because as a face he was fading. He seemed passé. He was old hat. He'd been playing the Hulk Hogan character, the red and yellow type Hulk Hogan character since, well, he'd done the babyface turn in AWA, and I think that was 1982 he turned. So he'd been a babyface for like 14 years in the States. Obviously, he played heel in Japan when he was wrestling Antonio Inoki and the other people out there. So he'd been the babyface for, I think it was about 14 years, 13 and a half years. So to do that heel turn was a huge risk for him to really stray from that character that had made him a multi-millionaire and the most famous wrestler in the world. But he absolutely went for it. He committed to it. He was all in on Hollywood Hulk Hogan, changed everything about himself, really. His whole style was, you know, working heel to put the faces over, doing the cowardly heel thing. I mean, I still remember seeing his matches, watching his matches from that era as a heel and just being amazed that he would do the things he did after seeing him, because I'd never seen, after only seeing him play like the babyface character. I think I'd seen clips of him in WWF when he was managed by Freddie Blassie. But I mean, he was kind of a primitive sort of character about then. And certainly as a wrestler, he was still fairly green. So to see Hogan play heel and play heel properly as someone who really knew how to work the crowd and do all the things that a heel does, I mean, that was just eye-opening. And the whole New World Order thing was just groundbreaking at the time. You know, I know it was based on the UWFI and New Japan feud that started the previous year and continued up until, I think it was April of 1996. I think it ended at, I think it was the Battle Formation Tokyo Dome show. So, I mean, it was loosely based on that. But it was still, for American wrestling, it was hugely groundbreaking. And Hogan, had he not been involved, I mean, it wouldn't have been anywhere near as big as it was, just in terms of how successful it was on screen, and also in terms of how successful everything was played backstage, because Hogan had creative control in WCW, as everyone knows, so he ensured that the NWO was kept strong for as long as possible because he was the central figure in it. So, yeah, I mean, absolutely deserved. You know, one of the greatest gimmicks ever, sold an enormous amount of merchandise. If you think back to WCW, Kenny, that was something they always lagged behind WWF on, was merchandise. They just never had their act together on merchandise until the NWO came along. They were always...
That was the changer for them.
Yeah, it was a huge changer for them. I mean, you would see NWO t-shirts everywhere just in, you know, normal everyday life as well. Yeah, I mean, it's really big. I mean, it was tremendous for Scott Hall and Kevin Nash as well. You know, so it's kind of weird, though, because I mean, I don't think it was ever really a particularly good gimmick for Sean Waltman. He was very much a background player. I mean, he went in as a member of DX, didn't he? So this is the second time for him as well, isn't it?
Yep, Sean Waltman is going to be a two-time Hall of Famer.
So I don't think he really should be there. As much as I respect Sean Waltman, I don't think he should be there. I think Eric Bischoff should be there. What do you think, Kenny? Anyway, I know you're a fan of the NWO, so
Yeah, I'm with you. This is Bischoff. Bischoff should be in this incarnation. So I just, yeah. I think if the Hogan Hall and Nash thing, then, you know, the Hogan Hall and Nash thing is totally valid. The Waltman thing, I feel bad because I do like him, but I just... It just, you know, it's who you know, I guess. Yeah. Who you know. I mean, if that was me and I was him, and maybe I'm wrong, maybe I'm just sitting here not... I would almost go, nah, I'm okay. Because I know that that's not what it should be, you know? But I guess when you get to a certain point, you can be talked into doing it, and that's kind of where it is. So,
yeah.
Anyway, so we've got the build to TLC for Sunday. We had some build on SmackDown last Friday. I don't really want to spend too much time on last week's SmackDown because it was pretty diabolical as a show. But I guess the most interesting part for me that came out of it was that we are going to see Bray Wyatt Firefly Funhouse version in action at TLC against The Miz. And yeah. We are being sort of teased with what this new Daniel Bryan is going to be like. He's obviously not back yet. I quite like the idea of seeing both Bray Wyatts and they're both involved and stuff. I think there could be a cool dynamic there. That for me was the big newsworthy item coming out of the show.
Yeah, it was unexpected. It's another dimension to the Wyatt character. The fact that he's going to wrestle in the jumper as this, because we haven't seen him. I don't think we've actually seen him in an arena yet, have we?
No, we've not.
As Jumper Bray.
We've not seen him in an arena yet, only backstage vignettes.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's going to be interesting just to see what he's going to do as that character. And also, I think this is a really good gig for The Miz. Even though we know he's going to put Bray Wyatt over, at least it feels like Miz is doing something worthwhile again. I mean, he's been floundering ever since the Shane McMahon feud, really. You can say, well, he's a settled man. He's just taking one for the team, but it's for a higher purpose, which one assumes is Fiend versus Daniel Bryan at Royal Rumble. Seems that's gonna take place there. Hard for me to believe they're gonna spin this all the way out to WrestleMania, but that is a Royal Rumble worthy title match. The Fiend or Bray Wyatt, if he's gonna be going out there in the jumper, versus whatever Daniel Bryan returns as. And again, you know, heavily character driven. And I think this is really an important point to stress, is just how important it is to get the characters right. When you got your character right in wrestling, well, to me, character pretty much trumps everything, certainly in WWE. So this is yet another layer to Bray Wyatt, who to me is, you know, he's run away with character of the year. I mean, there's no one out there that even comes close. Maybe the nearest one would be, well, gee, I'm kind of just kidding here. But you know the Su Yung character in Impact Wrestling?
Uh-huh.
She vanished and has returned as this angelic character called Susie. And it's just one of the weirdest things you've ever seen. And when she turned up as this new character, you're like, is that Su Yung? Oh, it is. I mean, anyway, back to Bray Wyatt. So, yeah, I'm really looking forward to this just to see how it all plays out and what he'll do different. And the Miz will facilitate everything. He'll do his duty. He'll get in there, get a bit of offense in. He'll end up doing the job. I think the most interesting thing about this is, will we see Daniel Bryan? Will he turn up at the end? Or will we be made to wait? I think there'll be, if he doesn't turn up, there'll be some sort of sign. Maybe a video will be sent in, Kenny. That'd be quite interesting, wouldn't it? If Bray Wyatt were to be in the ring after beating The Miz, and then Daniel Bryan were to turn up on the big screen in a pre-taped video. Maybe that will be what we'll see on Sunday. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I like the idea. Anything that's a little bit different is good. The Wyatt stuff really is saving SmackDown right now, because it just as a show. I mean, what did you think? I just found that, I mean, the fact that you're watching it on a weekend, you almost feel cheated at a part of your weekend.
I mean, I watched it this morning, so I watched it. Yeah, I was able to wait until Tuesday before I watched it, you know.
That's really testing your level of willpower.
That's it. Delayed gratification, Kenny. That's me. Probably the thing that amused me the most, I'm sure many other people caught this, where Drake Maverick was backstage with Dana Brooke, and he acknowledged that Dana was going out on a dinner date with Batista. And then Drake, even though he didn't do the wink wink, you know, we all knew. And Drake said, "What does Dave Batista have that I don't?" That's the question that keeps coming up in those Inside the Ropes Q&A specials, isn't it, Kenny?
It's come up once or twice.
So Elias turned up and then he mocked Drake, claimed that he bedded his wife. Drake was furious. He called Elias out into the ring. Then Elias beat down Drake, and then Dana pinned Drake with a foot on his chest as Elias counted three. It just kind of feels like a bit of a waste of Elias. I mean, Elias is better than this. You know, I hate to use that cliche, Kenny. It's a bit of a cliche, that one, isn't it? He's better than this.
But in this sense, it does really apply. So.
Yeah. So, I mean, we had a four-way between Revival, Heavy Machinery, Lucha House Party, and Shorty G and Ali. Elimination match to determine who faces the New Day at TLC. Really felt like this might be Shorty G and Ali's night. I mean, fans were really behind them, and instead Revival won. On commentary, even Big E sort of acknowledged, almost in a, well, not blasé way, because Big E never says anything apathetically, but he just mentioned that it would be like another rerun, you know, another match, you know, we'll beat Revival again. Revival were allowed a little bit of mic time afterwards. I mean, they sounded focused, they sounded determined. So they did increase my interest in the match slightly, because Revival were actually allowed to speak after the match. But, I mean, that's not really a pay-per-view match, is it? Revival versus New Day. Just illustrates how dismal the SmackDown Tag Team division is right now. I mean, it's like they're not trying, isn't it?
It's grim.
And then we had Roman Reigns versus Dolph Ziggler.
Oh.
I mean, it was a competitive match. King Corbin was out at the end. There's all these security people. So they ended up handcuffing Roman Reigns to the ring post and pouring dog food all over him. I mean, what a waste of perfectly good dog food, Kenny. What do you think?
Not since Ken Shamrock was forced by the British Bulldog to eat dog food in August of 97 have I remembered how terrible of an idea it was. I mean, this is like Fox paid for this.
Yeah.
To be part of their sports schedule. They've paid so much money that they have brought CM Punk in to analyse the show, and this is what they are going to be analysing. Like, can you imagine if tonight on Punk's return to backstage, they ask him about this?
Yeah.
My God. It's just embarrassing.
Yeah, I mean, it just feels like they're just treading water. I mean, in WWE's defence, this happens most Decembers. They don't really have that many ideas for the December pay-per-view. And they're just sort of killing time until the push for Royal Rumble begins. And I think, you know, I'm sure we'll get to TLC. TLC probably will be a pretty good show in ring. But I mean, the creative, the booking for it, I mean, it's not exactly invigorating, is it? You know, I'm not on the edge of my seat.
No, it's because it's funny. You watched this on Tuesday. I mean, is there any other, you know, big picture stuff from SmackDown that you want to discuss, or can we move on to Raw?
I don't really. I think that was about it, really.
Because then I watched Raw today. I watched Raw today, and I just thought Raw had so much more going for it as a show, just in terms of like. I mean, should we talk about the car crash first? That was
presumably the opening segment.
We got the divorce segment with Rusev and Lana, and one of my favorite things here is Jerry Lawler, who's presiding. Jerry Lawler had hoped, Finn, that he could get to the arena and help them patch things up. Jerry Lawler thought that he was the man to make sure they stay married.
Yeah.
So, but then
in his spare time, he's a marriage counselor.
And then he showed us a T-shirt he had on saying "King of Love," but the T-shirt was all in black. So he's dressed like he's at a funeral with a black suit jacket on. And then, I mean, out comes Lana. She's, you know, she's not acting for the back of the room. She's acting for the back of the state. You know, she's like, she's screaming to Idaho, trying to like get them to hear what's going on. Rusev's out there with a Donald Duck T-shirt on with a suit jacket over it. He looks thrilled that he's divorcing her. I mean, read into that what you will. And yeah, Rusev's just having a ton of fun with it. The fans are chanting Rusev Day. Lana's, you know, just making no sense. She is getting good heat, to give her credit. And then Lashley comes out.
But, I mean, a lot of it's really cheap, isn't it? She's just that thing where she's, stop booing me, and just using all these, you know, pantomime type.
There was no nuance to it, is what you're saying.
In
the end, Rusev, Lashley comes out, and Rusev says that he'll sign the divorce papers if he can get a match with Lashley. It's agreed, he signs it, Lashley goes to beat him up, and then Rusev eventually puts him through a table. I mean, I can't lie to you, in some morbid way I did enjoy it. But just because it was a car crash, what did you make of it?
Yeah, I mean, wrestling trash. I mean, it's like, I mean, each week, Lana is sent out there to participate in a segment like this that is always garbage. And clearly Vince likes it. I mean, they were out there for, it was the best part of 17 minutes, wasn't it? Maybe 16 minutes, but it was a long segment. So Vince obviously, he really likes this. Lana's given loads of lines to remember. And she's saying that she's smart and intelligent. She's blaming the WWE fans, partly for the breakup of her marriage. As you say, Rusev's out there with a... I mean, you know, Rusev's dress sense, it's just... he's like illustrating through his dress, conveying through his dress how ludicrous he finds this whole saga, this whole charade. The fact... I mean, you might as well have T-shirts printed up saying, yes, this is ridiculous. I mean, somebody in the crowd had a sign which read, Rusev and Lashley deserve better. I noticed that Lana wasn't mentioned by name on that sign. So Lana's there blasting the fans. She says, I used to love you, to Rusev. And, Rusev, after listening to her ranting, he couldn't wait to sign the divorce papers. But Lana's like, no, you know, you're making it all about you. You know, it's not all about you. And, of course, it's all about Lana. Lana wants to sign the divorce papers first. Then they end up having this, like, random argument about who gets custody of the dog. And that wasn't resolved. So, I mean, I think, you know, they need more mediation there, Kenny. You know, we need to get someone to sort that out.
I tell you this. If myself and Steve Gunn, you know, the pseudonym for my other half, if we were to break up, there would be no questions of who gets custody of Hulk. Hulk would stay with me. Yeah. That, you know, the fact that they didn't get a prenup on the dog, that's their own fault.
I mean, well, that was probably the realest part of this segment, but they didn't manage to sort that out. So, you know, Rusev wanted the dog. Lana wanted the dog. Then, you know, whose dog was it? Lana, I think Lana said she bought the dog. Who knows? It all rolls together. So Rusev says he wants a match. He wants a match with Bob. You know, that's Bobby Lashley.
Big Bob.
So Lashley says, you know, Lashley comes out. Then we end up having the brawl. And as you said, Rusev put Lashley through the table with a belly to belly. I believe the match is taking place. Will the dog be, Will the dog be involved? I mean, at least work the dog into this.
Dog on a pole match.
Well, I'm not saying that. But I mean, you know, that fact that they brought it up and made a big deal about it, to me, you know, if you're trying to tell a coherent story here with a start, middle and an end, or I mean, I know that's difficult with Lana involved, then I think the dog has to be part of it. I mean, why else would anyone care about this match? At least if, you know, the winner gets the dog, at least it gives them a reason to have a match other than to amuse Vince, and so that Lana can wear another short, you know, dress, very short fitting dress that exposes her cleavage, which it's what it's all about to Vince, isn't it? It's all about Lana and her cleavage. Lana, you know, she's giving it some tits and teeth. You know, that's what Vince wants. He's saying that to Lana, go out there, love, give it some tits and teeth. And she does that.
Tits and teeth. Oh, I feel like Les Dawson's on the other line. Did you think that 3 months ago, Finn, that you would be championing for the inclusion of a dog in a Rusev and Lana divorce storyline? Because that's where we've got to.
Well, no, but to me, it's the only way that this match can be saved.
It's by the dog.
That's right. You know, I'm not suggesting it should be. You know, it can all be done very humanely. You know, it can all be done in a very nice way. You know, hopefully it won't be. I mean, we could have the dog backstage because, you know, some dogs get distressed, don't they, in front of audiences. And we remember Pepper the dog. What happened to Pepper, but that dog always looked frightened to death.
I mean, I was going to say we know what happened to Farrow when Farrow came out with Cody and the pyro went off and the dog just went. I mean, dogs do not like pyro. Let me tell you, they do not like fireworks. They do not like them. So, I mean, but yeah, Pepper ultimately fell to a far worse demise.
That's right. But I mean, in reality, we know that's not what really happened to Pepper. But in reality, that dog always looked frightened to death whenever it was, you know, around people it didn't know or noise. So maybe just have the dog in the back. I don't know, but you could have winner gets the dog. But there again, if Lana wins, would that then result in this storyline being prolonged? And I think most of us are hoping that a line is drawn underneath it this Sunday.
There you go. Well, over on elsewhere on Raw, we finally got the heel turn, the full-blown heel turn of Seth Rollins. Kevin Owens was looking for him. They had a promo in the ring. You know, Owens was not being an idiot. He was very much kind of, you know, saying that he doesn't believe Rollins. And then later in the show, when Owens is going to find AOP at their van, they attack Kevin Owens, and in the van is a hooded man. He unhoods himself, and it is Seth Rollins, who then comes out and cuts a promo in the audience talking about how, you know, finally he's going to, you know, use the negativity against him as a fuel for himself, and, you know, he's now going to get everyone back. And he cut a pretty good promo, actually. What do you make of the how this all played out with Owens and AOP and Rollins?
I mean, I've got to say, I was a bit disappointed. I thought the payoff was pretty limp when Kevin Owens. I mean, I never like it when the babyfaces smash cars up for no reason. And I'm sorry, but this is kind of a reality moment here. I mean, why was Owens smashing that vehicle up? What message does that say to the kids, Kenny? You know, so he's smashing that huge van up, causing all this damage to it. So he's trying to break into the van, and then the AOP attacking from behind, and then, as you say, Seth Rollins comes out of the van, and I was expecting there to be more of a response to it. I really feel like this story could have been a lot better. There could have been more layers to it, more twists and turns to it, and it just feels to me like they just ended it prematurely. Didn't really seem to be that much heel heat on Rollins when he came out after they'd beaten down Owens, and he stood, you know, shoulder to shoulder with the AOP, so they're now officially a unit. That was confirmed here, but I don't know, it didn't really feel to me like Rollins really put his back into it. I mean, I've always felt that Rollins is better as a heel because he's somewhat kind of smarmy about him as a babyface. Somewhat, you know, he's just kind of difficult to like as a babyface. But I didn't think he came across as, there's not that force of character or charisma there. It's not dynamic. I just don't feel like I was getting a lot of, you know, aggressive energy from him. And I think when you're a heel, that needs to exude from every pore. And it just didn't. So I think I would have rather seen the payoff to this story at TLC. I think I might mention this last week. where Owens and Rollins were having the match, and then AOP came out. And then at the end of the match, AOP finally revealed their true colours when they beat down Owens, enabling Rollins to score the victory. Then Rollins leaves with AOP. He scores the win over Owens. And Owens is in essence protected because the AOP have caused him to lose to Rollins. So I would have scripted it like that. I think that would have been a superior outcome to this. I'm not really that interested in seeing Owens and Rollins wrestle now. I don't know. It just
do you feel like from what they're doing, is Owens, are they building Owens for something bigger, or is he a fall guy for Rollins?
I don't know. It doesn't feel like either has come out of this very like heated up, and that's what one of these angles is supposed to achieve. And it feels like both of them, I'm not saying they're cooler than they were a week or 2 weeks ago, as in tepid temperature, cooled them off as characters or as wrestlers. I don't know. I just don't feel like this is really advanced either's career. I don't really feel like either has really gained anything from this so far. Just felt like the whole thing was a bit of a misfire. I mean, they can turn it around at TLC. Absolutely, they can.
We don't know what the match type is going to be yet, but yeah, we assume they're going to fight at TLC. What else did you like or not like on the show?
And can I just mention one other thing also about the Owens thing, Kenny? Last week on Raw, the AOP dragged Owens backstage. Was that ever really acknowledged again?
No, we didn't. I mean, Owens was looking for them now as revenge, but we didn't find out what happened to him.
Could you give us some sort of answer and payoff to that?
I mean, that would be a good idea.
Kind of dropped.
Maybe Kevin Owens was dumped in a field and Rusev and Lana's dog found him. And then the dog signalled for help on the high. And I'm just thinking about a way to introduce the dog more.
Well, yeah, I mean, they did introduce the dog verbally, so...
Let's have the dog over two stories.
Yeah, that went nowhere. And kind of also, I mean, I know they did acknowledge this when Rusev played like a highlights video of what had happened the previous week, you know, namely Lana and Lashley being arrested. But did we ever get any sort of explanation of what had happened there or what their punishment was?
No, we did not.
So to me, that's two glaring omissions in week-to-week storytelling from Raw. How many people write this stuff, Kenny? How many people do they employ? I mean, I know it all...
I think it's 20.
I mean, it's all... You know, it's all Vince. It's the top of the line guys and women who are the ones who, you know, the book stops with them. It's their responsibility, not the lowly writers. I don't buy that at all. They're just doing the nuts and bolts work. They're taking instructions from on high. But I mean, that's two huge omissions from this week's Raw in two of the biggest angles from last week's Raw. I mean, that to me is inexcusable, Kenny. Now I've completely lost my train of thought and forgotten what you asked me because I went off on one of my customary tangents.
That's what people are here for, Finn. They want your tangents. No, I was going to ask, just to kind of finish off the main podcast, what else did you like or not like on the show?
We seem to, again, have a lot of matches that didn't really seem to achieve much. We had Becky Lynch versus Asuka and Kairi Sane. That did achieve something there. That set up a match this weekend.
And to be fair to them, they did in the pre-match promo where Charlotte offered her help, and in the post-match promo where Becky asked for the help, they did at least reference that they are not friends and that it wasn't just a we are teammates. So even though I think that, you know, fair about some of the Kevin Owens stuff, I think what they have done is some of the baby faces don't look as stupid as they used to. So at least that's a win. At least they're not seeming as... Because sometimes you just don't even get an explanation for it. So at least they did with that.
Yeah, they did that. So we've got Lynch and Charlotte versus Asuka and Kairi Sane at TLC. So that should be a good match. Looking forward to that. We had Buddy Murphy versus Zack Ryder. That was like essentially a squash. Murphy and Aleister Black will square off. That probably will be a pre-show match, I would imagine. Imagine that would be a kickoff match.
Yeah.
Doesn't really feel like... I don't really have any faith at all in WWE doing anything meaningful with either Black or Murphy. We had Humberto Carrillo. He defeated Andrade, didn't he?
He did. The push apparently has restarted.
Yeah. I mean,
how many people do you think, Finn, has purchased or have purchased the brand new Humberto Carrillo T-shirt?
I don't know, a couple of dozen? I don't know. So, I mean, I guess the only interesting part of this was that Andrade lost after he'd crashed into Zelina Vega, who stood on the apron, and Andrade and Vega yelled at each other and blamed each other for the loss afterwards. That's about the only interesting part of this match. And if these two separate, I think that'll be bad news for both of them. But in saying that, Andrade's been on this stop-start or start-stop conveyor belt all year. You know, a conveyor belt going forwards and backwards, rather. I mean, it's one step forward and two steps back. So I imagine when they clash again, he'll win. But it just doesn't feel like he's going anywhere. And I think the guy's a real talent, but they've got to let us know that he's a priority and that he's somebody who can be a star, really within the next few months. Otherwise, it could be over for him. And he'll be typecast as a second match guy that people can't take seriously. Or it'll just be more difficult for people to invest in him emotionally. And you know what WWE's like. Oftentimes, they don't have much patience with certain performers' pushes. And if it doesn't take on week three or week four, they just give up and move on to someone else.
But with WWE, if you watch WWE, what you're watching for and what you're hoping for is a good character. Because if you're nobody's watching WWE expecting the best wrestling in the world. That's not what you're watching it for. You don't go to McDonald's to get nutrition. Do you know what I mean? Like, that's not what you do. So to me, it's just like,
no, you don't. Why do people go to McDonald's?
Because sometimes you just want a dirty burger, Finn. Sometimes you just want a bit of crap, you know?
I don't get it, Kenny. No,
well, you know, you look at like you're,
when you get to my age, you know, it's full-time maintenance. You've got to worry about these things.
I mean, look, you're in very good physical shape, so obviously you don't see McDonald's like I do on the Uber Eats app at 2 a.m. when I'm pissed. But that's another story for another time. My point was going to be is that, you know, Humberto Carrillo and Andrade or, you know, whatever, like, matches that are good matches, I just don't think that that's going to get Carrillo over. What's going to get him over is a story, because, you know, I've got in front of me an old issue of Power Slam that we're going to be reviewing for the Overrun, and it's the PS50 from 2003. And if I look through the people in WWE who are on the list, you know, Kurt Angle, Eddie Guerrero, Brock Lesnar, you know, people like that, they're, even though they're great wrestlers, they're also great characters.
Don't forget John Cena. I'm sure he was in there.
Well, he's not in the top fucking 10, is he?
I think he was in the PS50 one year, believe it or not.
But the only, the only person really here I'm looking through, there's a couple. I mean, Paul London, but he hadn't wrestled it. Benoit. Benoit's like the only one really who, Benoit wasn't really a great character. He was just a great wrestler. So you can get like a one or two here and there. But WWE is more of a story company, so you need to be a good character. And Humberto Carrillo just has no character. And I just, in 2019, I don't think people really care about plucky young babyface.
No, definitely not. It just feels,
do you know,
nice
who's more over than Humberto Carrillo? Dominic Mysterio. I'd rather see him.
He just feels like such a lightweight, doesn't he? You know, in terms of character, not just in terms of body size.
Here's the question, Finn. Would you go for a pint with Humberto Carrillo?
Well, probably, yeah, because, you know, if you were to win his trust, he'd probably sit there for like half an hour complaining how they're not using him properly. And that's an interesting conversation to have with a wrestler. I've had many of those conversations with
wrestlers. Would you have the wee recorder on your front pocket?
Well, maybe. No, of course I wouldn't.
Well.
So, elsewhere on the show, we've got Liv Morgan. She's going to be going through a makeover. I don't think that's going to make much difference to her, I'm afraid. we had probably the two things that annoyed me the most about this program, apart from the half dozen or 100 things I've already mentioned, was the Viking Raiders beating the Street Profits, I thought, far too quickly. I thought the Street Profits did not put up anywhere near enough resistance there before they lost. What do you think, Kenny?
So to me, even though SmackDown had a lot of shit, figuratively and literally. I think the most egregious thing that I saw over the two shows was the Viking Raiders squashing the Street Profits. Because you get the Viking Raiders who look like they're just like going to like, you know, a war cosplay thing on a Saturday afternoon in a field. Right?
One of those battle reenactment things.
Battle reenactments, yeah, that's where they're off to. And then you get the Street Profits who are like legitimately cool. And they're fresh, and they're, you know, they just feel like one of the next up and coming big acts. And I just was struggling to go, right, okay, they lose in 2.5 minutes or 3 minutes. What can the reason be? And I couldn't find one. And I'm just going, like, so Matt, for example, Matt Hardy loses on the show. He loses because, let's be honest, we know his contract's coming up. We know he's not re-signing, so they're going to job him out. That's what's happening.
Yeah.
But with the Street Profits, you go, these are such a big, hot act that could be a main-level team. I'm not saying they have to beat the champions, but why on who thinks it's a good idea to go, I tell you what would really, you know, make them sympathetic if they lose to the Viking Raiders in 3 minutes. It doesn't get anybody... It doesn't do anything for the Viking Raiders because the Street Profits don't feel like a big enough threat to them yet, and it cuts the legs out from the Street Profits. So it just... You know, people who complain about, you know, booking on shows of any other company, this was right up there with one of the worst things I've seen them do this year. After the Street Profits had really been maybe the best act coming out of the draft that they were actually doing a decent job with in building them.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I echo all those comments, Kenny. It's just very disappointing. And I mean, they did like a segment later on, didn't they, where they pretended to be newsreaders and they reminded us of all the matches that were taking place at TLC, which hadn't really been promoted very well. So, I mean, it doesn't appear that they've totally given up on them. But I mean, that was a bad night for those guys.
You know, yeah, that was bad.
And the only other thing I would bring up as well was the bizarre sight of Sami Zayn turning up from SmackDown as a manager with Mojo Rawley, who Kevin Owens had earlier slapped backstage because Rawley was basically ridiculing him.
Very quickly, I'm sorry to interrupt you in a flow. Okay, so you have 20 writers, right?
Yeah.
Who are writing for a national television show with a company that's worth... are they worth billion? Are they worth over a billion?
I think they reckon they're going to hit $1 billion gross this year.
Okay.
They reckon the first time. If not, it'll be very close.
So worth $1 billion gross this year with 20 writers from various backgrounds, and behind it, the marketing genius of the man who took wrestling to an international level. The writing... for Mojo Rawley, Kevin Owens says, "Have you seen AOP?" And Mojo Rawley looks at him and says, "Yeah, they went that way," points to his right. And then he said, "Actually, they went that way," points to his left. And they said, "Actually, they went that way," and puts both hands in the opposite direction.
Yeah.
That is the level of dialogue that these people are being paid to do.
It's like, this is why they pay the big bucks. I mean, it's like...
Can you imagine if you're watching that with somebody who doesn't watch wrestling? They're going, really?
Yeah, you watch this. So you watch this, do you? I try defending that. You know, it's just piss poor. It's just like, you know, if you had asked any fan to come up with something better than that, any fan would have been able to come up with anything better. I mean, who cares about Mojo Rawley? I mean, why is he even still in this company?
And also, what was he wearing?
I don't know.
It was like he'd went home and tried to make his own homemade Under Armour gear and ran out of material.
Or maybe it was something that he made for Roman Reigns about 6 years ago. Found this in the warehouse, Mojo. You can wear it.
Sitting beside Farooq Assad's gear.
You know. So Owens ends up slapping Mojo Rawley. And I remember when that happened thinking, oh my God, is this going to lead to a match? Who really, or something involving Mojo? I mean, who cares? And then Sami Zayn comes out and he's just like, oh yeah, you know me from SmackDown. So the whole brand exclusivity was harpooned for this utterly worthless segment with Sami Zayn and Mojo Rawley and Kevin Owens.
Then he applied for a manager's license.
He applied for a manager's license. I mean, that's another one who's had an absolutely dreadful year, Sami Zayn. I mean, it's just like, just meandering. It's like clearly they've got no idea what to do with him. And I don't know if this is all linked with him not going to Saudi, and maybe it's some sort of punishment there, or it's something else. I mean, I'm not sure what's going on here, but they have, for a guy who's got so much talent, and we know Sami Zayn is a really talented guy, and he's putting these dire segments, and he makes the best of them. I mean, you couldn't salvage this. This was never going to be any good, no matter what Sami Zayn did, because it was doomed from the off. But Sami Zayn's a guy who goes out there and gives it his best shot and can do lots of... I mean, let's face it, the guy can do almost everything in wrestling. He's never going to be a top guy, we know that. But he can be a really effective mid-card player. And in this role, he's just adds no value whatsoever to the show each week. He comes out with Mojo, and Owens ends up stunnering Rawley and then blasting him with the pipe. Zayn retreated, and that was that. So yeah, the Raw stroke SmackDown exclusivity clause, which I know hasn't been adhered to strictly, but usually is, they just trampled all over that for this segment. I just don't know what to... I don't know. I have no more to say on this, Kenny. Said enough.
Well, with that in mind, that's the end of the podcast. So, Finn has no more to say. That's pretty much it for us. Finn, we are going to go over to the Overrun and do some old Power Slam stuff. We'll even maybe touch on the WWE releases that have just happened. But
what about TLC predictions as well? We can just quickly sprint through them, I'm sure.
Yeah, they've only announced 3 matches, which only takes 45 seconds. We'll put the amount of effort into that they did.
As usual.
As usual. What are your plugs? Where can people go to buy your lovely ebooks? Because if you didn't know, ladies and gentlemen, he once interviewed the Honky Tonk Man for The Interviews Volume 2. Lengthy interview, covers the length and breadth of the career of the greatest intercontinental champion of all time. Where can people find that and get to know you a little bit more?
Oh, well, people know my website's finleymartin.co.uk. Some information up there regarding the Power Slam t-shirts. You know, I hope you would go and check that out. Where can people find you, Kenny?
I should say right now that we are neck and neck in Power Slam t-shirt sales and Humberto Carrillo t-shirt sales. So if you just bite the bullet and buy a Power Slam t-shirt, Finn's going to go to number one. So
That's it. I need that majority. I know I need that majority this week. Give me a majority.
We don't want a hung t-shirt sale department. Anyway, so you can find me on Twitter at KennyMC1985 or Inside_The Ropes. You can get tickets to our upcoming events with JR and Conrad Thompson in February and Kenny Omega in April at insidetheropes.co.uk/events. You can also go to our YouTube channel, youtube.com/insidetheropes, for bonus video content, interviews with Eric Bischoff, Chris Jericho, Paul Heyman, Mick Foley's coming up there soon, some stuff from Starcast with Cody and Brandy and Dustin Rhodes. And you can finally go to patreon.com/insidetheropes, where you can get this podcast 24 hours early. We do an overrun there. We do cover more stuff. Finn does articles. We'll have something coming out before the new year. There's a 5-page Bret Hart interview where he covers a ton of topics we didn't get to in the tour, including the British Bulldog, the state of wrestling, women's wrestling, AEW, and much, much more. We also do pay-per-view reviews, retro pay-per-view reviews. So if you have a spare bit of cash, you know, cost you the pint of a drink or two at the pub for dozens of hours more content a month. So we hope that you will give us a try.
Definitely. We're going to be reviewing a Armageddon tomorrow, aren't we, Kenny?
Armageddon 1999. God help us, but we will be. So yeah, thanks for listening, everybody. We will talk to you soon. If I be tonight, if I'm sad tonight.